The next matter on our calendar for oral argument is Homestead Acres Homeowners Association versus Hiscox Insurance Company. Good morning, counsel. While you're getting settled, I'll just remind you of our court's procedures. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you both state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because it is being recorded. The podium can be raised and lowered to your liking with the button that's under the middle. And I think with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Chris Goodman, and I represent the appellant, Hiscox Insurance Company, in this matter. We raise two issues for the court's consideration in this appeal. The first is the respondent's failure to appoint an impartial and disinterested appraiser, as required under my client's policy and also Minnesota Statute 65A.12. The second issue is the fact that the time to commence this action expired before the suit was commenced. As to the first issue, there's no dispute that the policy requires the appointment on both sides of an impartial appraiser to resolve a dispute over the amount of loss.
I want to make sure I understand your lack of partiality or your partiality argument. If I'm understanding the record correctly, your client was aware at the time this appraisal process was going forward that Mr. Barthelemy and appraiser Lathrop had a relationship, that they had worked together for 5 years and was often in the situation that they were in this case, that one was the appraiser and one was the client, if you will, or the party. You had your client had knowledge of that.
The fact that they've worked together before,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so yes. The only piece that you claim was renders the appraiser not impartial is the fact that they own this cabin property together.
Not knowing the how time is spent or what relationships exist outside of them appearing in appraisals, yes, all we knew was the number of times that Mr. Lathrop and Mr. Barthelemy had worked together appointing one or the other on appraisals, yes. After we get the award in this case, after we try to resolve the claim, and after the offer is accepted, we find out through a third party that they own vacation property together.
Why is that qualitatively different than knowing that these two people routinely are on the same side, if you will, of appraisal proceedings, where one is hiring the other and vice versa? Why is this ownership of property something that's qualitatively different?
Because that's an entanglement of a whole different sort, Your Honor. The fact that they're working together as public adjuster or appraiser, or in some instances one as the umpire on the panel, that certainly raises a bit of concern, but I certainly wouldn't recommend to my client that we run to court and try and get one of them removed simply because they've worked together in the past. But we have them owning vacation property together with tax liabilities, maintenance, upkeep responsibilities. This is where people would go to either together as their families to use the property or to take turns sharing it. This is the kind of financial entanglement that in the cases we cite, there's not a lot of case law on this in our state, but the Newmec case, for instance, the Bebo case that actually the respondent cites, these are the kind of entanglements that this court has been concerned about in the past.
Let's set the entanglements aside momentarily. I am hung up on the fact that the judge in this case says, you raised a new argument, and the new argument is what you're saying, that that there's impartiality in the appraisal. Isn't this an affirmative defense that should have been pled? And if that is the case, why are we even considering your argument about whether or not there was something wrong with that relationship?
We did not know about this issue at the time we moved to dismiss the case, answered the complaint, or any of the settlement negotiations occurred.
I thought in response to Judge Bjorkman's question that you knew that these parties had had prior relationships. Maybe I misunderstood your response.
Yes, we knew about that. But again, that was not the fact that there are some people appear on the same panel frequently is cause for concern on my client's side. Trust me, they would like that to be an issue.
Doesn't that go to due diligence if you're looking at who the panel roster is and you have an umpire and you're selecting a person? I mean, this is your defense in connection with a claim that's been raised under the policy. So was that not your responsibility?
No, Your Honor, because first of all, we don't have any means of just of conducting discovery or getting a verification.
I don't know. You know, people check out what the judges' backgrounds are. We check out the lawyers' backgrounds. You check out who's going to... Yeah, I mean, that's a part of life. You want to know the qualifications of someone that's going to be doing work or performing work that affects the gist of what your dispute is.
I don't think it's appropriate to fault the party that's relying on a representation that this is an impartial and disinterested appraiser to say that it's our fault for not finding out earlier that there was something untoward going on. I would also add that the legislature has said in the Minnesota Arbitration Act that there needs to be a certification from the arbitrators that they don't have any conflicts or these kinds of entanglements.
But this is an arbitration matter, and the court is... Our Supreme Court has held the Arbitration Act does not apply to it in the appraisal context.
So we don't have that safeguard, is the point. And so when a representation is made that this is who we're going to appoint as our appraiser, we trust that policy is being fulfilled and there's no misfeasance or malfeasance. I don't even remember the difference between the two, but nothing untoward is going on. But the part of the reason why we're here today...
And I'm going to know, I took you out of the entanglement and then I brought you into the procedural aspects, but now I want to turn back to what I want you to educate me here, because I look at the fact that there was a claimed loss and for your reasons, you disputed the nature of the loss or the reason for the loss, which doesn't concern us today. But in any legal dispute, you can make an offer of settlement, and then it can get accepted. And if it does, and a party then acts on it, and there's meeting of the minds with the email exchanges saying, good, we got this offer. Why is that not a contract? You don't need to go through all of these other steps, do you, in order as an insurance adjuster to reach accord with a insured as to a claim loss. We've all had insurance losses. What's wrong with the insurance company saying, yeah, I agree, I'll pay you the money? Why are we not back with what I think is law school 101? What am I missing? I just can't catch up with you on that.
I'm not understanding the question, Your Honor. We proceeded to attempt to negotiate a resolution of the claim once the amount of loss was determined at an appraisal.
You could have settled this claim the minute that they said we had hail damage and they say, I want $1 million. And if you, on behalf of the insurance company, would have said, okay, that's good, and forget all of the appraisals, forget all of the stuff that goes, that's a deal. What's wrong with that deal having happened despite the appraisals that came in?
If I'm understanding Your Honor's question, you're asking why didn't we settle the claim instead of going to appraisal?
Well, why, you could settle the claim any time. Do you agree with that?
Of course we could, Your Honor. Parties are freedom to contract.
You could have disposed of this without having appraisals involved, period. Do you agree with that?
Yes, and may I answer, Your Honor, why we didn't do that?
Yes.
Okay, because there was a dispute as to the amount of loss. The estimate that the insured provided was different significantly from the estimate that our independent adjuster at a company called Engel Martin prepared.
At some point then... The insured pitched you an amount out of $500,000. I can't recall what it is. They pitched you amount, and at that point, if you wished to stop, which apparently you did, you made a counteroffer and it was accepted. Why is that not something that you have to abide by under simple contract principles?
Now we're talking about the agreement that was reached. Yes, Your Honor, we're not saying that there was not offer acceptance. What we're saying is it should be set aside. Because the only reason why we went to appraisal, the only reason why we made an offer, and the only reason why the respondent has the right to bring my client to court is because of the policy. We had a right under the policy and Minnesota statute to have the award, the appraisal award, issued by an impartial and disinterested pair of appraisers.
Can I ask you just a question about that? Because I think in the background of Judge Werke's question is the idea that the impartiality of the appraiser would be a breach of the insurance contract. But why should we agree with you that a breach of the insurance contract, even if we agreed that you showed impartiality, would be a breach of the settlement agreement or a reason why that contract should not be upheld?
Yes, I apologize if I wasn't tracking Your Honor's question, but that's the district court's rationale. That was the argument that the respondent pitched, that, well, we're trying to enforce the settlement and that we can just all pretend that the policy doesn't exist. And that's why I was saying, Your Honor, and I'll say again, everything flows from the policy. The right to appraisal, the right to demand payment, the right to bring my client into court, it's all based on the policy. What does contract law 101 tell us? If you breach the policy, you can't enforce it. The party that breaches the policy that is damaged.
Enforcement of the policy, right?
Pardon?
They're not seeking enforcement of the policy, they're seeking enforcement of the settlement agreement. And you could have had, the appellant could have had any number of defenses that were compromised in reaching the settlement agreement, some that might not have been known until after they made the settlement agreement. So why should we treat this as different than any other settlement agreement where, you know, 6 months later you might come across a witness that would have been a good witness for you versus this situation? What's the difference?
The law should not be and is not in this state, fortunately, that a party can profit from misfeasance, malfeasance, the Fenwick case we cite, for example, to secure rights in a contract. The other part of black letter law that I was going to say before Your Honor's follow-up question is the parties should be returned to the position they would have been in before the breach. Think of it like criminal context, the fruit of the poisonous tree, right? What's the sequence of events here? Everything flows from the policy right to demand payment, and if we don't agree on the amount,
right,
go to appraisal.
Let's stop there. All right, you talk about policy rights. Policies have many, many, many rights. That doesn't mean that you necessarily invoke those rights because you can reach a settlement anytime. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I've said before the parties are free to contract. We had the policy says, we say in our brief, there are two circumstances under which we will pay for a covered loss. We agree on the amount of loss, or if we don't, we go to an appraisal and we get an award.
But what if you decided you didn't want to do the appraisal partway through? You decided that the appraisers were taking too long, it was COVID or some reason that you decided, even though it was your right to have appraisers, even though it was the insured's right to have appraisers, is it not true that at any point you could say, let's just forget that and let's have an agreement?
Yes, and what I'm saying, Your Honor, maybe I'm just not understanding the question. I don't know how that changes what we're talking about here. We certainly had the right, again, under the policy, to resolve the claim if we reach an agreement on the amount of loss. We've never disputed that.
And isn't that what we're here about? We're here about Hiscox's breach of the settlement agreement, right?
For just cause. It was we negotiated based, the settlement negotiations that we cite in our brief were expressly based on an amount that was determined by the appraisal panel. The award was signed by the umpire to break a tie, because our appraiser didn't agree, and appraiser Don Lathrop. That then gets into Your Honor's first question, our concerns that we found out long after this settlement occurred involving the relationship between the two of them. And to say that we could run to court and set the whole thing aside simply because they'd worked together in the past, I can tell you from personal experience that wouldn't work. But from our perspective, the fact that they own property together is a whole different ball of wax than they get together for appraisals.
Defense, it seems to me, to having to pay. Didn't you give up all your claims defenses known and unknown by entering into this full settlement, full and final settlement of all claims arising out of this hailstorm?
We didn't get to the point of putting it, memorializing it in writing, Your Honor, so there is no agreement like that. It was just, we'll settle the claim for this amount. But what again I'm saying, in the case law that we cite in our brief supports this, if these are later discovered facts, right? That's the circumstance we're talking about. Those are a basis to set aside a settlement when a party is trying to profit from material information that they didn't disclose. And yes, I suppose it's possible if we hired background checks, we might have been able to find this information out. But the law, I don't think, requires an insurance company to be snooping around the backgrounds of an appraiser appointed for a property
after
appraisal.
After the fact, though, I thought you backed out of the agreement because you thought there was some kind of a defense, or it was it wasn't because of the names of the appraisers. Wasn't that after the fact?
I was talking about our motion for summary judgment. That was the first issue that we've been talking about for the appeal. Now, at the time,
but the reason,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I think the record says the reason you backed out of the settlement that you had agreed to was you realized it was untimely under the tolling agreement, or at least that you reached that conclusion.
Yes.
So it wasn't about any appraiser. It was you saying, oh, gosh, they don't have time anymore under our tolling agreement.
And I thought we were talking about the summary judgment ruling. Now, with respect to the issue we raised at the motion to dismiss phase, because at that point when the suit was filed, we weren't aware of the property ownership. That is the tolling agreement. And the law in our state is clear that if the time to commence suit has expired, then there isn't jurisdiction conveyed. The service of the pleading is a legal nullity.
But you also didn't serve them with any notice. So that's a mutual thing. So how does that? Yeah. When I look at that, I think the tolling period is still out there running. The train is still going down the tracks.
I've got 35 seconds left, so I'll just summarize as best I can. The agreement says that the tolling period commences upon receipt of settlement of the appraisal award notice. It is undisputed. Both parties received it on May 12. The next paragraph says written.
Well, received, but by email, not by.
I'm getting to that, Your Honor. The next paragraph 3 says written appraisal award settlement notice shall be made to the following addresses. It does not say the manner of delivery. The Valspar case that we cite in our brief in the Supreme Court addresses that. In Valspar, I'm going to be down here, but I'll finish spitting out and stop talking. The Valspar case said that notice shall be in writing or hand delivered. There was an email. The court said the method of delivery was specified. Email was not sufficient. Okay. In our case, it says written appraisal award settlement notice shall be made, doesn't say mailed, shall be made to the following addresses. So to inject the words or their interpretation into the agreement that it cannot be by email is contrary to what the agreement says. And last thing I'll say, the person listed on the agreement when it was signed in 2019 for my client was Tony Crawl at Mirren Gear. He hadn't been counsel since 2019.
All right, counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I think we understand
Sorry,
your answer.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. Justice Lindell for the plaintiff, respondent, Homestead Acres. Your Honors, this case is about a settlement agreement that was reached. We shook hands. There was a meeting of the minds. And then later, Hiscox changed their mind. They decided we missed an opportunity. We could have argued something. We could have argued something. We don't like the settlement. We want out. So they threw together a theory. Let's say that the statute of limitations had expired for this settlement. So we're going to crawfish on it. We're going to break the agreement. I personally have never had that happen before, and I found it disturbing. Handshake's always been good enough for me in 20 years of practice. Setting that aside, reach an agreement, 2 weeks later, you know what? We changed our minds. We're not going to do it because we're going to assert that the statute of limitations expired. That was the entire reason why this lawsuit started. That's it, period. Expiration of the statute of limitations. And let's be clear, we had negotiated a settlement because Hiscox said, we're not going to pay the appraisal award. We have contractual defenses to payment of the appraisal award under the policy. We don't have to pay it. We said we disagree, right? We don't think that those contractual defenses will work. And in addition to those, the appraisal amount, which was a little over $500,000, we've got $125,000 worth of pre-award interest that we're entitled to under Minnesota statute. We want, that's 625 plus another, I think it was like 17. So we're into the $640,000 range. Back and forth, agree, disagree, $500,000, yes. So we shake hands. So we've got, the claim is resolved. We've got a separate statutory right for pre-award interest, also resolved by the settlement. Get a letter, not gonna pay you. We sue, motion to dismiss. Right out of the gate. Hey, statute of limitations has run. So we've been through all these discussions about, well, are they suing under the policy or are they suing under the breach of the settlement agreement? Well, obviously we're suing under the breach of the settlement agreement. I wrote the complaint and that's what it says. It doesn't say anything about breach of the policy. So it's a waste of time to have to deal with arguments that it's too late to bring a claim for breach of the policy. That's not what this case is about. It's a breach of the settlement agreement. We brought that lawsuit within a month of the breach, well within the 6-year statute of limitations.
You would agree if, and I know that's your position that the appraiser was not partial, but you would agree if that there were some you can agree with the hypothetical case of some egregious type of fraud that underlied the settlement negotiation, that would be a colorable defense to enforcement of that settlement agreement.
Absolutely.
So why is this not that case?
Number of reasons. First, there's the issue of materiality. We've talked several times, well, I heard several times during the argument, the words misfeasance or malfeasance, right? And that comes out of the Mork and the B-Boot cases, very old, right? But that's the idea that you can get an appraisal award overturned if there was fraud on the panel, right? So I don't know, maybe somebody took a blowtorch and moved it around on a bunch of siding, and then they go, oh, that's part of the fire damage. I need my siding, not just the roof, right? Some kind of fraud on the panel. Or misfeasance or malfeasance. Left very ambiguous, but Mork and B-Boot go ahead to define that more clearly. It has to impact the outcome of the appraisal award. And so they say, so if there's some gross outcome from the appraisal process, so you've got fraud on the one hand, somebody got fooled, right? There's more, like there's made up damage or a lying witness of some kind, fraud. Or the misfeasance or malfeasance, which means that there's an improper outcome that they have, you know, what the appraisal panel comes up with is flawed. That's what those cases say. So then, and that's how we get to this whole materiality, et cetera.
But isn't the idea that the public adjuster for your client had skin in the game, so to speak, because his fee is based on the recovery that he's able to help your client get, and then he's the one that recommends the appraiser. So as I understand the appellant's argument, that is the connection that causes serious question into the validity of the appraisal award that's made by the umpire and your appraiser. What's your response to that?
They have never phrased it that way. That's never been their argument. I think the way that you're saying it makes it somewhat more understandable, Your Honor, but that's just not true. Right, so the public adjuster ordinarily has a percentage fee that's predicated on the outcome of the appraisal, right? Or it's actually predicated on the amount of money that the insurance company writes checks for. So every public adjuster has a pecuniary interest in the outcome of the appraisal. So if that's a problem, they're all
I think from their standpoint, as I read the argument, the issue is that on top of that, then they own this home together.
Right.
And so, you know, if he is compensated by virtue of a favorable appraisal award, that clearly benefits the both of them because they can put the money into the home and they have an existing business relationship.
So
my bigger question is there anything in the record to give us pause that what the umpire and your appraiser came up with was grossly disproportionate in comparison to what the insurer's proposal was?
Two sides of that answer. First, no, there's absolutely nothing in the record. Jim Stoops was the appraiser for Hiscox. Jim Stoops says that his disagreement with the appraisal award was that he didn't agree with the date of loss. He didn't think it was because of a June 11, 2017 snowstorm, period, dot, that's the end of it. That was his disagreement. Materiality, right, that would get somebody to an equitable estoppel, that would get somebody to overturning an agreement saying, hey, I didn't know X. I relied on X when I made that agreement. So now we're going to undo it. Because either you didn't tell me or you lied to me. It's got to be material. The case law tells us that the materiality for an appraisal is a gross outcome in the award. There's no evidence of any gross outcome in the award. They had the opportunity. They talked to Jim Stoops. He puts in an affidavit and he says, A, I've known that these two guys are buddies for over 10 years. So this whole, oh, they own a vacation property together. So what? So what? All it means is that they're friends. The case law tells us that they can be friends. Northwest Mechanical says that. And Mork and Bebout say that. Yeah, you can have a personal relationship between the party and the party's appraiser. And that had better be the case, frankly, because in this context, like Engel Martin, Mr. Nonhoff put in an affidavit, Engel Martin does virtually every appraisal for State Farm in the state of Minnesota. So if there's a problem with a previous relationship with a long-standing, hey, these people work together on insurance claims, we'd have to pick all new appraisers, adjusters, everybody. But the most important thing is Mr. Stoops said the only thing he disagreed with was the date of loss. He didn't disagree with the amount. That's what he said in his affidavit. That's where his, hey, I thought it was a different day. There no statement that there was any problem with the actual amount, right? So there's no evidence in the record.
The amount would be zero because he didn't think that the amount that your appraiser was and the umpire were settling on were at all related to the loss in question. Or am I misunderstanding that?
Well, I think all we have to do is look at Mr. Stoops' affidavit because that's what his testimony is, all right? I don't want to make up things and put them in his mouth. When he put together an affidavit for this case to talk about the problem with the outcome of the appraisal, his identification was, I disagreed with the date of loss.
Yeah, he didn't think there was a hailstorm on June 11th, 2017.
He didn't say anything about there's no way that there was $500,000 worth of damage. There's no way that a contractor could reasonably charge $500,000 or $400,000 or whatever for these repairs. And he didn't say, and there's all kinds of stuff that wasn't broken that the umpire and the appraiser said that we should fix that I disagree with. You know, there was no damage to the roof. There was no damage to the windows or whatever. He didn't say any of that.
But don't appraisers, I mean, yes, they're trying to reach an agreement on what the dollar amount of the damages.
Yes, ma'am.
But I mean, they do also look at surrounding facts, like was it caused by an event on one particular day. So I'm not sure how Mr. Stoops' affidavit testimony that my disagreement was on the fact that there was loss at all on that day. How does that change your argument about lack of impact by the alleged partiality of your client's appraiser?
So, okay, a couple of things, and I just want to really briefly get back to Your Honor's question. So there's nothing in the record to say that there was a disproportionate outcome to the appraisal, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that there's any pecuniary interest in the outcome of the appraisal on the part of the appraiser, Donald Lathrop. Zero, nothing. There is no pecuniary link between Mr. Lathrop and the amount of the award and appraisal. He gets the same appraiser fee regardless of if it's $1 million recovery or if it's a $2 recovery. He has an appraiser fee, he writes a check. It's not a percentage based on the outcome. So there's all this hypothetical speculation, all these adjectives. Yeah, these guys are friends, always have been, everybody knows that. These guys knew that, Jeff Nonhoff knew it, Mr. Stoops knew it, there's no difference. But going back to Your Honor's question, the burden of proof is on the party who's saying, hey, you gotta undo this deal. I relied on this, right? The cases tell us there has to be some gross outcome with the appraisal in order for anything to be triggered. There's no evidence of any, quote, gross outcome. If you look at Mr. Stoops' affidavit, he's got, and I thought this was very, I gotta tell you, I thought this was very straight up by him because he didn't pull his punches and he didn't hide anything. He says, Hiscox's own expert gave meteorological reports. This is paragraph 11 of the Stoops affidavit. Hiscox's expert gave meteorological reports that indicated there was a hail of an inch in size or greater on June 11, 2017. And then he goes on to say, now there was meteorological information that showed there were hail on, and he gives, I don't know, seven different dates, one of which is June 11, 2017. And he says, after looking at all this evidence, I concluded it wasn't caused by June 11, but rather was one of a different, it was on a different date. That's it. That's his disagreement. Two of the three panel members said it was June 11. They agreed that it was June 11. One of the panel members did not agree it was June 11.
No one disputed it was hail damage.
No one disputed that there was hail damage. There's no statement there. The amount of damage totally, you know, that's out of line. No statement at all. I want to touch on, there was a fantastic question about, isn't this an affirmative defense that was never pled? Yes, absolutely. We talked about that at the summary judgment hearing. I did not counter appeal on that basis, but I thought it was completely inappropriate. There's no affirmative defense of equitable estoppel or anything similar that you find in the answer to the complaint. The excuse that is given for that is, well, we didn't know at the time. Well, that's interesting, right? Which is in itself an admission, hey, the whole impartiality kick, that was way hindsight. That's way last minute. We tried other defenses and they weren't working, so we scrambled to come up with an excuse not to write a check for $500,000 because we don't want to. So what they came up with was, maybe we can cobble together this impartiality accusation. Well, at the time they did that, they should have omitted their answer to assert it or omitted their disclosures. This is how litigation works. There's no trial by ambush. You can't show up with surprise witnesses. Well, guess what? Mr. Stoops never identified as a person with knowledge or what he had knowledge of. We had a discovery period in this case. If we had been alerted that there was going to be some allegation or a major defense in the case asserted on the basis of an alleged estoppel from material misstatements and omissions, then we could have taken discovery on that. I could have taken Mr. Stoops' deposition or Mr. Nonhoff's or whatever. But it never came up. There was never any discovery into this. It wasn't Mr. Stoops, not in the initial disclosures. Mr. Nonhoff, not in the initial disclosures. The affirmative defense itself, not in the answer, never updated, no warning. We bring a motion for summary judgment, and the first information we have about, oh, there's an alleged non-impartiality defense is in the moving papers for Hiscox's motion for summary judgment. Completely inappropriate. Which I think is a separate independent ground for affirming the district court, setting aside the district court's absolutely correct statement that there is nothing that amounts to an estoppel. The fact that estoppel, that this whole argument was never pleaded, never disclosed, came up for the first time in summary judgment is a separate independent ground for affirming the district court. And that really gets back to, I think there's a few sort of main issues. There's no real answer to one of the first questions that your honors asked, which is, why is vacation property different than having a friendly relationship? It's not the friendly relationship that is the predicate for this allegation of impropriety. The case law tells us they can have a friendly relationship, that's fine. And everybody knew they had one. There was no non-disclosed friendly relationship. There's this just over and over again. Oh, but they own a vacation property together. That's totally different. Well, why? No answer, just a bunch of adjectives. It's troubling. Wait. Impartiality is either, it would either have to be the personal relationship or it's pecuniary. There's a tie to the outcome of the appraisal. They knew about the personal relationship, so that can't be it. It has to be pecuniary, and there's not one shred of evidence of any pecuniary interest by Mr. Lathrop in the outcome of the appraisal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Goodman, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Number one, we did plead estoppel in our answer. It's in there. Number two, Your Honor's question was about why is this or is not the cabin ownership material. And I believe the answer was basically, well, it wasn't a big enough dispute in the award. And Your Honors, I think follow-up question addressed this. The tie between the two appraisers is broken by the umpire. That's how the appraisals work, right? On the one hand, Your Honors were read from Mr. Stoops' affidavit. He says there is no award here because the damage to the property wasn't caused by the date of loss claim. That's zero. If the umpire agrees with Mr. Stoops, no money is recovered. The appraiser, Mr. Lathrop, on the other side, actually probably doing it this way, for the insured says it's an over $500,000 loss, and some number is reached. I don't have the exact award memorized, but that's what the umpire agreed with. And so, yes, it is a material difference because the umpire breaks the tie, but Mr. Stoops was not saying, as counsel respectfully was representing to the court, that there wasn't a dispute about the money. There was. There couldn't be more of a dispute. It was zero versus $500,000 or more. Okay. Now, in terms of the case law,
Let me ask you about case law.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just to throw you off track. You cited Valspar as a reason why the emails aren't binding in this case. So is that something that should be precedential, that we would be making some type of a statement as to what constitutes an exchange, or is it simply that the language of this particular insurance policy says, I can't remember your words, shall, what do you see on that, or give us some guidance?
Valspar fits on issue number two, which is the tolling agreement. The tolling agreement is not part of the policy. And Valspar says if a contract specifies the method for which notice must be provided, in that case it said hand delivery or mail, then an email doesn't suffice.
Right, okay? But that's the contract is that's the insurance contract, and the suit was on the settlement agreement, right? I mean, this sounds like a really good defense if the insured had sued based on the insurance contract, but the insured sued based on the settlement agreement, which doesn't have a limitations clause, which doesn't have a tolling agreement. What is your response to that?
That gets to the Henrick case, non-precedential. Looks like what Your Honor's question tracks that case. And we distinguished that in our brief. I'll take another swing at it here. In that case, the contractor, the defendant, is hired to perform construction work, but they do it defectively, and the limitation period expires. The contractor has performed, but defectively. After the limitation period expires, a new promise or new undertaking, I believe it was new promise is the word the court used, is made to go back and remedy the stucco defects. And the suit was on that promise, okay? In the Henrick case, there was performance, there was defective performance, there was an agreement after the limitation period to come back and render new performance. In our situation, because this is an insurance policy, my client's obligation is to indemnify for a covered loss. We will pay under two circumstances, an agreement or the appraisal panel establishes the amount of loss. Okay, we have not performed. That's why we were sued, because we didn't pay. All the settlement agreement does is specify the amount of money. It's not a new agreement. It's not like we've agreed.
So
go ahead, Your Honor.
I'm troubled by that argument. I mean, insureds and insurance companies have disputes all the time about what the obligations under the insurance contract are, and cases get settled all the time. And from time to time, there are motions to enforce settlement agreements. It seems to me if we adopted your consideration, I think that's the argument you're making right now, that you would really be upending long-standing case law about honoring settlement agreements between insurance companies and insured.
Right. So first, my comments were about the Henrick case. That one turned on the fact there was a new promise to render new performance. That is
not
the case.
It wasn't an insurance case.
I understand.
Different
kind
of case.
The second part is, and these are the two arguments we've raised on this appeal, parties should not, and the case law says they will not be allowed to, unclean hands, if you will, enter into a contract by concealing material information. Your Honor's question to my opponent was why is this material information, why is it not? And that gets into the distinction between Mr. Stoop saying it's a zero award and Mr. Lathrop saying it's more. Then the second part then, second issue I should say we raise in the appeal is the tolling agreement. The time to commence suit had passed, and we cite the Bresnik case, which happened to be pretty much on all fours from the Supreme Court in Connecticut, where the offer was accepted after the time to commence suit had expired. The court simply says that then renders the agreement a nullity because there was nothing to accept. And so we're not asking, my client and I, we're not asking Your Honors to upend insurance law. We're saying that if you enter into a settlement agreement after the time expired, you run the risk that you can't enforce it. And there was no discussion, as they concede in their brief, to even try and extend the tolling period. And so it passed. And for those reasons, we'd ask Your Honors to reverse and dismiss the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
Thank you.